honestly, at the time, I still didn't realize really what I was going through. I didn't know a lot about mental health and, you know, so some of the sort of some of the trigger points. And so it really, some of the things I was going to was obviously going up, you know, unchecked and undiagnosed as well. So, which was obviously simmering under the surface, and I was still not looking after myself like how I should either. So those unhealthy coping mechanisms were still happening.
That's Ben Hirst. Starting on the 12th of July, he'll be climbing twice the height of Mount Everest by trekking up and down the slopes of Mount Wellington in Hobart. It's the latest in a long line of ultra endurance challenges that he's been pumping out over the past 8 years to raise awareness and funds for mental health. His passion comes from living through his own struggles, which have included a drinking problem, lack of purpose, and suicidality. At his lowest, Ben made the split-second decision to end his life when he happened to see a bumper sticker that stopped him. A decade on, he's a fulfilled father of two, working in suicide prevention for the Tassie charity Speak Up, Stay Chatty. If you're keen to support Ben's campaign, head to the link in the show notes. Welcome to Young Blood, the award-winning volunteer podcast dedicated to young men's mental health. My name's Callum McPherson, I'm a journalist, and this is a platform for everyday men to share lived experience stories and show that no matter what you're going through, you're not alone. Suicide is the number one killer of young people, and changing that starts with speaking up. So let's do it. This episode has been made possible by Pro Realty Property Consultants. Pro Realty is a proud sponsor of the Young Blood Men's Mental Health podcast and a big believer in the importance of mental health awareness and suicide prevention. These legends swooped in with funding support at a time when we really needed it, and it's thanks to them we've been able to keep the show going. If you're looking for a commercial real estate agency you can trust to deliver quality, Pro Realty has a team of experienced professionals with the knowledge and expertise to provide you with a wide range of specialist services. Get in touch with their friendly team today to discuss how they can best assist you and mention Youngblood in your inquiry for a discount.
Trigger warning, if you find anything spoken about in today's episode distressing, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Ben, what was your experience working in hospitality?
Oh, look, hospitality was such a challenging environment. It was exciting at, you know, at the peak, lots of a million things going at once, lots of stress, lots of, it was an industry that where you were doing a lot of things that probably wouldn't be accepted in a normal workplace. But I think the amount of stress and what the industry demanded really created this environment where people in the industry had their own coping mechanisms, and whether, you know, to deal with some of these, you know, mental health issues that they were coping with, and that could be overindulging in alcohol, drugs, not getting enough sleep. And it was a real eye-opener for me as a young guy coming into the industry, not knowing anything about this. So it was tough, yeah.
And you were a chef. What drew you to doing that job?
I didn't know what I really wanted to do coming out of school. And so I was lucky enough I went into a variety of different classes, and one of those was hospitality, and they said, you know, by the end of the year everyone will get a job. So I thought, great, you know, so I did some work experience, got a job as a kitchen hand, washing dishes and making desserts and just doing general stuff for the chefs, and eventually got the opportunity to do an apprenticeship, and I still didn't know what I wanted to do. So I thought, you know, that I guess that's something, you know, that's experience that I can fall back on. So I just continued on. And yeah, made some really good friendships throughout the whole experience, but it was full on. Yeah.
So you actually liked that environment, because I was a waiter for a bit, sometimes being a dishy randomly. And so I've spent a little bit of time in kitchens, and kitchens are super hectic, as we know. I can imagine it would be very difficult to get up and continually operate in that environment and keep your head. And I was around some chefs who were using drugs to be able to cope with that. And that sort of seemed like it made sense, just because they're under so much pressure, and then the sleep schedule as well being messed up. There's a lot of things against people working in hospitality, and then the culture of knockoffs and what to do afterwards. And of course, it's the middle of the night when you finish. So, but you actually liked that environment for quite a while.
I think I really reflected on this, and I think I liked the environment because I play a lot of team sport. And I love that team environment, and there's no better team than a kitchen. I think you have to work. Everyone works so good together because they need to be able to get the volume of orders and the amount of different things that you've got to juggle being in a kitchen. So I think as a 17-year-old coming in, I thrived off that team environment and doing what I can to actually help out. But obviously the environment that you need to cope with, you know, such as long hours, staying up late, you know, you start to get, I guess as a team, you start to get involved in some of those things that other people are doing. So, you know, I think alcohol ended up being for me something that I really got into because others did as well. And, you know, I don't know whether it was peer pressure, but I think it was probably a bit of both. Like I felt like I needed that to get through and probably to de-stress a bit and make things feel like it was like I felt that, you know, I did get quite anxious having to think about backing it up for a service, you know, knowing that it was going to be, we knew what the, how stressful it was going to be, but having, I think taking the edge off a little bit, having a bit of alcohol certainly helped, but it's not sustainable.
And in an environment where a behaviour is normalised and you say, oh, well, I do it, but everyone does it, so whatever, it's normal, very hard to tell if you might have a problem. How did you come to realise that you had a problem with it?
I didn't realise I had a problem probably till I was reflecting on when I was out of the industry. I think you get so caught up in your own bubble and, you know, getting to day to day with what you're doing. And if you're hanging around with people that think that's just normal as well, it's really hard to look from the outside in. I think it made going on from hospitality, I think it made things worse down the track because it was my coping mechanism going forward. But it took a long time for me to realize, you know, that was a habit that was unhealthy, but also it wasn't helping me moving forward with life as well. So I think, yeah, it was something that no one really spoke to me about, and because they just thought that was just, I think there was probably a lot that I did hide from people going forward. But yeah, you know, when you're part of a group that is all doing it, it's really difficult to recognize what you're doing.
So what did that problematic drinking look like for you? Because it can be different for everyone. Doesn't mean that you're outrageously drunk every day and people are probably going to notice that. But was it drinking a bit every day or did you go over a certain line? How did you define that?
So, I mean, when we were in hospitality, there would be, you know, I would wake up in the morning hearing the crack of a can. So my, you know, one of my mates would come to pick me up for my shift at about 11 o'clock, 10 or 11 o'clock. So it'd probably be around 9:30 where he'd come out, the back door was open and he'd come through and he'd get a couple of cans out of the fridge and he'd crack one open. I'd wake up and he'd hand me one and I hadn't even got out of bed yet.
So that was the coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we might have a couple in the morning. So we'd head to work and then you'd have a split shift. So you'd work from about sort of, you know, 10:30 till about 3:30. You'd have that time, you'd have about an hour and a half between having to come back for your dinner service. So we would, you know, share a six pack, you know, in that middle as well. We were quite good because we used to partake in it every day. So we kind of knew where not to cross and where we could work efficiently. So we knew that if we were having too much, then we couldn't do our job properly. It made up most of our day. It was, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner, you know, that's it. That our sort of day revolved around that. And I think that was probably the most unhealthy thing.
Why did you want to wake up and have a beer first thing? Because most people would think, oh, well, that's when you'd have a coffee. Can people who aren't alcoholics or drinking to that level in that environment would say, oh, maybe I can understand the afternoon one in between shifts. That makes more sense. But they're getting up, having the beer straight away and normalising that. How did you think about that back then?
I don't think that we saw that as, like, especially the breakfast one. I think we'd normalised it so much as having a coffee. Like for us, that was just a way that we used to start our day. And yeah, looking back on that, I know now that, you know, that's obviously not accepted and, you know, not good for you. But I think it just ended up being a bit of a ritual for us. But it would just be that same sort of that's how we used to operate. So I think it ended up being a bit of a, yeah, it ended up being something that we just resorted to each time. So I don't think we used it, like we did end up using it as a coping mechanism, but it just ended up revolving around our day-to-day life and being able to just take a bit of an edge off. So when we get into such a heightened environment, we were sort of, you know, we were ready to go. So yeah.
Do you think there's a way to handle that level of pressure without any vice, without any help? I mean, there certainly would be people out there who do it, but it's so common and it seems almost wrong to put people in such a stressful environment where they have to resort to something like that. If you had to go back there, I'm sure you probably wouldn't, but if you had to go back in that environment, do you think you could do that job without drinking?
Yes. Yeah, I believe so. I certainly think that more needs to be done when, especially for, you know, in the industry, there's a large number of people that have just gone into it from school or are quite young, and there needs to be more done with sort of coaching that, you know, working with young people to find out what, you know, what they need it for support in terms of getting them ready for that, some of these things, because in the industry, I think, you know, it's old school mentality was sort of, it gets quite stressful, and the way people handle stress is very different depending on who you are. And some people that have been in the industry for quite a while, they're just used to being yelled at and abused, or, you know, just told what to do, and there was no question about it, because it's all about authority. So when they eventually get to that sort of place of authority, they end up doing the same thing to their chefs, and I think that's that sort of vicious cycle that happens in hospitality. I reckon the industry is probably a lot better than what it used to be. So head chefs and second chefs have a real responsibility to drive culture in kitchens. And I think that would make a big difference. We had a reasonably good culture at the time, but I think more can be done with supporting young people that are learning, and also just teaching them the way, because I think if you're saying that's okay for that behavior, then, you know, others coming through are going to see that and go, oh, that's what I should be doing.
Yeah, especially, you know, when a lot of people starting in kitchens are, especially if they're starting as dishes, they're teenagers, and then they might be on the bar, they might be 18, they've just reached legal drinking age themselves, and you're going to mirror whatever you see probably from whoever the more senior staff are. And I suppose it's just going against that culture where it has been normalised for so long, because it is a bit of a different environment where people are coming in to drink and eat, and being part of that's just accessible. And yeah, it's not like you should say, oh, you absolutely can't drink after work or on your break or whatever. That's for individual businesses to decide. Yeah, I think just looking after young people and making sure that they have positive role models and positive coping mechanisms is important. And yeah, limiting the abuse and the stressful part of it. It's always going to be stressful because there's so much demands, but just really good leadership would go a long way. And I'm sure there'd be plenty of 100%. Kitchens out there where that is the case and people are much better off for it. So you actually left that job and then you went on for a fairly decent run of other jobs that were also pretty stressful in their own way and not all that fulfilling. Can you tell us about where you went next after hospitality?
Yeah, so I recognised in my mid-20s that I really needed to make a change. I wasn't completely passionate about the industry, but I needed to get out of working nights and weekends and trying to have a bit of stability, because it can be isolating working the opposite hours to your friends. So what I did was my uncle was a financial planner at the time, and he helped me get the skills to get into finance. So I thought, look, you know, finance is sort of 9 to 5, perfect, you know, a bit of stability and, you know, it pays well as well. So I decided to you know, do a bit of study and then make the move. And so after, you know, quite a few job interviews, I managed to get a job at a bank, and, you know, quickly you learned that it was probably still, there were still elements of that job that caused a lot of stress. And you know, I think culture, you know, toxic culture played a huge part of that. And I've said this in the past, I reckon working in that banking environment was actually harder than hospitality at the time.
Why was that? Yeah.
Because I felt less supported in my role. And I think what happened was that there was top-down pressure. The way that the industry was set for prioritizing money over people. And so what happens is that you have executive managers pushing, you know, for numbers, and then that puts pressure on the managers. Then
yeah,
and then
the trickle down.
Exactly right. And so people really are all worried about their results and not worried about themselves, like helping
themselves.
And
everyone's putting pressure on the person below them because they're getting it from above.
Yeah.
And you'd really feel like a cog in the machine in a job like that and like a number.
100%. And in hospitality, it was a lot more simple. We just we got an order, we cooked it, and we just got through that service, where this was where we're really having to get numbers and sales, and it was all about that, nothing else. And if you didn't perform, or you were having a bad day, it wasn't about asking why that is, or how you're doing it, and ask about the person. It was demanding, well, you know, and I think, just getting into.
Well, they'd like actually make light of it, wouldn't it? Wouldn't they? Your failures, and sort of hang you out to dry for everyone else, and use it sort of as scare tactics, I suppose.
Yeah, the people that were doing really well one day, you know, you're at top of the leaderboard, and you know, you're really well promoted and supported, and those people, unfortunately, that were, and it can be luck of the draw too. You know, someone could get a call in, and you know, they got a sale straight away, and they were at the top. So some people that were at the bottom, yeah, they were really put in the spotlight, and the pressure with, and they put more pressure on that person, and you know, that pressure, it's not a, they didn't really ask about the person. It was just because, you know, because that pressure was coming from the top. It just wasn't handled very well, and I don't blame any the direct managers for that, because they're under the same amount of pressure too. So it's an industry thing. But I found that, yeah, it just, the turnover, since I was there for a year and a half, and there was already three teams that had left since then. So that says a lot about the industry and the stress and the support that people have been receiving.
Mm. Yeah. So that wasn't for you either. And then you went to the airport.
Yep. So it was the first time I ever quit a job without having something to go to. So I actually went back to cooking, because I put myself in such a poor mental health space that I just had to leave. And so, yeah, went back to working in the airport, and obviously, you know, early hours and quite challenging, but it was a small kitchen and it wasn't as hectic as a, you know, having a full restaurant of people day to day. So it was a bit of a step down, but it was enough for me to kind of reset from the challenging environment that I had prior. So,
and how was your mental health around that time, and how conscious were you of it?
It had probably hit an all-time low from that. It had built up, and from that stint at working in finance, it had really, sort of hit its peak from that. And honestly, at the time, I still didn't realize really what I was going through. I didn't know a lot about mental health, and you know, so some of the trigger points, and so it really, some of the things I was going to was obviously going up, you know, unchecked and undiagnosed as well. So, which was obviously simmering under the surface, and you know, I was still not looking after myself like how I should either. So my, you know, the coping mechanisms were still. Those unhealthy coping mechanisms were still happening. And so, you know, something's got to give after that, I suppose. But
to anyone?
No, because I don't think the environment, I mean, the environment that I was in, yes, still, I think still didn't give me an avenue to be able to be honest and open about that.
What about your family and friends?
I honestly, when I'm thinking about that, I still felt quite like a burden. I didn't want to burden any of my family or friends about what I was doing and or what I was going through. And also, I didn't really know how to verbalize it either. I think it's really hard to talk. If you don't know what you're going through, it's really hard to talk about it and how and tell someone about that. And it also makes things a lot more real when you actually say it.
So what was going on at that time? What were you going through on reflection?
So at the time, I felt like a bit of a failure. You know, I think there was a number of things that I thought I should be doing that, you know, I think social media had a big part to play as well. You know, you would sort of, you'd go home and you would look at, people would sort of post all their sort of successes and amazing things that they were doing. And sort of when I was around, I'd be around sort of mid to late 20s at that time. And, you know, some people have been really, you know, buying houses and getting married and all those sort of significant moments in life. And I felt like I was back to square one, and I really had no direction on what I wanted to do. I was actually in a lot of debt at the time, and I, you know, there was a lot of things that I just felt like I was really failing at life, and they were eating up at me. But I felt so ashamed to be able to talk about, because I spent a lot of time, a lot of effort pretending that, you know, things are actually really good. It's really draining trying to put that act on. But I know a lot of people do that, and that's why it's really difficult to recognise some of these signs in people.
It's important to look after our mental health just like our physical health, and AG1 is the perfect supplement to help take care of both. Just one daily scoop of AG1 covers all your nutritional bases with 75 vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, adaptogens, a greens blend, and whole food ingredients. You can count on this tasty mix to boost your energy, increase mental clarity, help you get better sleep, improve digestion, and pep up your immune system. Plus, it's super simple to make part of your morning routine, all for the price of a coffee. You may know producing this podcast is all volunteer, and I have to pay for studio time and editing to keep bringing you these episodes. Every dollar we make from this partnership will go towards helping to cover production costs, so it's an awesome way to support your health and contribute to young men's mental health all in one. If you're looking for a simpler and cost-effective supplement routine, AG1 is giving you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/youngblood. That's drinkag1.com/youngblood. Check it out.
Well, comparison is the thief of joy, as we know. And I think your situation, you're an example of someone who couldn't necessarily put your finger on any one thing, and you didn't have something that stood out, such as a traumatic event, which you could say, oh, well, that's why I'm feeling this way. You just had this gradual sense that you weren't happy in your life and things weren't going as they should be going, and you were under various pressure, like financial, and not sure sort of where to turn. And because you've got this build-up of things that are problems, but people would say, oh, that's just normal life stuff, that fosters the attitude which you had of, oh, well, I've got nothing to complain about. I need to just not say anything because these aren't real issues. Everyone's got problems. And then I think that's very, very common for people, because we know that mental health is a continuum. It's not just, oh, you're mentally ill, or you're normal and you're fine and you don't have to worry about it at all until you're severely mentally ill. We're on this continuum, we're constantly moving along from one side to the other, depending on whatever's happening in our life. And I think generally, as a society, we've been conditioned to think that unless we're in crisis, unless we're suicidal or we're heading that way, then we really don't have anything to complain about. You know, unless we're in the psych ward or something really extreme, then we better just get on with it. But of course, that attitude is what leads to so many people ending up in the red zone in the first place.
For me, you know, like I waited far too long to eventually, I waited when I was in crisis. And I think that's still happening today. You know, people don't get, you know, people get to that stage because they are not supported, or they don't know enough about, you know, how to, you know, strategies to look after their own mental health, but also, you know, being able to just talk through what you're going through at the time so that it doesn't just build up and get to a stage where, yeah, you're in that heightened state of not being able to support yourself either.
And so, hard to recognize if you haven't been there yourself before that it is going to progress and it's not normal to feel depressed or really have this hanging over you for a period of months at a time. And from my experience, it's not something that just stays where it is. It progresses and things end up getting scary, but it can sneak up on people in an insidious way where you don't realize how far along you've gotten until you're in that crisis situation.
Yeah, that's right. And I think for me, it certainly, it certainly progressed quite slowly, but there was certain, moments where, some nights were terrible. But for me, I still didn't really recognize that, what that was. So it is sort of, I know that at the time I felt a lot of shame with, how I was feeling, but also, because I didn't really know what I was going through. I couldn't really, it was hard to verbalize as well. So it was hard to tell people how I was feeling, what I was going through.
And did you hope it would just go away if you got a better job or you've met a girl or?
Yeah, I think so. I was waiting for someone to, like, that moment to save me, really. Like, and I thought changing my circumstance, so whether getting a new job or, like, I thought that would be a quick fix. I think, that would have been a Band-Aid solution going forward anyway.
In some respects, you could say it needed to come to a head. Tell us about that day when it did come to a head.
I guess for me, it got to a stage where, I felt quite suicidal, and when I was heading back from one of my shifts at the airport, it only really had, I felt like I was at such a state where the most smallest thing really set me off. And, I was driving back from a shift. And I'd done an early shift. I hadn't got much sleep, and I was driving this really, really old car, and the mirror actually fell off mid drive. And I looked at, and that kind of, that was the last straw for me. I felt like everything was not going right for me. And I made a rash decision to, want to end my life then and there. I hadn't had any plans, solid plans in the lead up, but I just couldn't get past it. And I think when that happened, I'd made that decision, and as soon as that happened, a car went past and I just caught a glimpse of that, there was a sticker on the back of the car, and I distinctly remember it, and it was then the sticker was this, speak up, stay chatty sticker. And for people that don't know, that's a local suicide prevention and mental health charity that Mitch McPherson created, and that drove past. And that actually, just for that moment, I thought, actually, I knew what that stood for, and that just changed my mind just for that moment. And I decided not to go through it last minute. And, from them going forward, I just had to take a moment and go, well, it happened so quickly. And as you mentioned earlier, you can have your moments where it just creeps up on you. And I think for me, that at that moment, I made, a rash decision that, could have had really awful consequences. But at the time, I felt like I couldn't push further than that moment.
That sticker, did you think, I need help? I need to go and get help?
Yeah. Look, It, as simple as it sort of sounds, just seeing that sort of symbol, I knew what that symbol represented at the time. And I saw that as a sign at that moment to go, no, like, I do need to try and reach out to someone here. I can't keep doing this. What I'm going through at the moment, I don't necessarily know, but I need someone to help me at this given moment. And from that, I never spoke about that moment until really late last year. So I spent over, I would say it would have been eight or nine years ago now, and I never, I spoke to it. I actually told Mitch on his podcast for the, and I hadn't spoken to anyone. So I still held a lot of shame onto that moment. And yeah, even being a mental health advocate, I still held that story in. And partly I still felt a lot of shame on that moment, because, you know, I know now that, you know, there's been I know where my life is now, and I go, you know, that could have never happened, you know. So I think that's probably why, a bit of the reason why I felt like I couldn't, you know, speak about that moment.
Yeah, and you wouldn't be a partner and a father of two and someone who's raised tons of money for mental health and an advocate and a leader, and the serendipity of working for that organization that was on that sticker.
Yeah, yeah. Thinking back then, I didn't think that I had the capacity to do these things. But I think the journey of my life has sort of led me to being in this space. But, you know, that's why I always think that, yeah, we can make these decisions, but God, like, you just don't know. You just don't know where you're going to be, you know, and how much of an impact one person can make going forward. Whether it was a coincidence or not, I'm so grateful for that moment. And, you know, that's just, yeah, it's just changed everything for me. And, you know, that's why I, you know, going forward, you know, supporting Speak Up, Stay Chatty just means the absolute world to me. And I'm committed to helping others, you know, in those situations, to try and get past, you know, and try and help them navigate, you know, the system and try and get past where they are, you know, just to help get through that, those times.
And you've become someone who's part of those life-changing moments for other people, which is a very special thing. So you should be very proud. But we know it doesn't just go, oh, I saw the bumper sticker, so I decided to pull out of that what would have been a terrible decision, and then everything was all good and now I'm sweet. I'm sure it wasn't quite that easy. How did you go about actually manifesting and becoming the man that you are now from there?
Oh yeah, it was a long journey. It was a few years. It was reaching out to people. I found was getting into the ultra marathon running, I think, and also meeting my now wife, you know, Jess. I think those two things is what catapulted me into, you know, getting better, but also focusing on some, you know, really sort of healthy habits. But, you know, something that, and, you know, the ultra marathon running, especially boosting my self-esteem and starting to do things that I didn't think I had in me. And I think that sort of flowed onto my life, going, well, if I can do something like that, well, what else can I do, you know? So I think the ultra marathon sort of side of things was a huge booster for me.
Do you see that as a coping mechanism, a healthy one, or that training, and also what comes with that is discipline and having to cut some of the other things out? And I definitely don't have what it takes to do ultra marathons, but I imagine the mental clarity that you get from taking something like that on is pretty useful as well.
Yeah, I recognize that I have a pretty like addictive personality, and for me, if I'm sitting on the couch doing nothing, then that's not good for me. I need to be out and doing something, and ultra marathon running was perfect. You know, I had found something that I was challenging, you know, it was engaging. It was something at the time that not many people were doing either, you know, sort of 8 to 10 years ago, that, you know, it was really underground.
Is this pre-David Goggins?
He was doing it, but it wasn't a big thing out in the open.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, trendy,
so,
yet.
No, it wasn't trendy. So, yeah, when I started doing it, it gave me a medium to go, oh, this is how I share my story. And gave me a medium to be able to share my mental health journey at the same time. So I was sort of combining the two things. So it didn't just feel like I was just completely hammering, you know, mental health stuff down people's throats. I'm combining it with this, you know, with this running. So
yeah, so it's like your vehicle for self-expression, and then it opens up those conversations, which is why you still do it to this day, because people are like, oh, why why would you go and do that? And or be amazed by that. I want to talk to you just about the physical feat, and then from that you can extrapolate and speak about the motivations behind it. It's a good system. It's a good formula.
It's great, and it works, you know. And I you never know, like especially early on, you never know who's listening. Like I just, you know, I'd be being pretty vulnerable and putting things out there, and you obviously don't. The people that are listening aren't usually the ones that will comment on it. So you don't know. But, you know, down the track, I've had conversations with people that have got plucked up the courage 3 years later, have read a post ages ago. And you know, they tell you their story and they go, that post, you know, what you wrote allowed me to do this. And then now I'm at this position. They're the sort of things that you just go, wow, I didn't realize the courage it took for me to write some of the things that I did out and just put it out there. You know, what I thought was I was going to be met with a bit of criticism, or, you know, people were going to block me or whatever. But you don't realize those people that don't contact you online, and you just, you know, that you've made a massive impact, but you don't always necessarily get that straight away. So there's a lot of, with this sort of stuff, there's a lot of you putting yourself out there and putting your,
It's like you with your moment, yeah, with the bumper sticker. Like, you happen to see that at that moment on that day when you were spiraling like that. So for a post, for example, someone might see something that you've posted, and that might be that day for them, and that might be enough to plant the seed in their head of, maybe I shouldn't do that today. Maybe I should go and say something to someone. And who knows how many times that happens, but that's why we should be putting stuff out there.
It's been amazing to see, because people have also gone through the same journey, but then they're also wanting to be able to do the same sort of thing, you know, go on and do a run and, you know, raise awareness. So it does flow onto some of these other events that do go on mass scale and reach more people. And so I never underestimate the benefit of sharing your story, because you're not the only one going through it. And that's a big message to say, you know, for people not to feel alone in what they're going through, because it can be so isolating being by yourself and then being in your own head, you know, and catastrophizing some of these things, because you think that you feel like you're the only one that is going through this or feeling this way, but actually there's lots of people in the same position. So yeah, it's a great way to do it.
What do you think the benefit is of realizing that there are other people who are also feeling the way that you are feeling or have felt that way?
Being able to have someone to relate, you know, and go, well, you know, this is how I was feeling, and I know how you are too, you know, but I also know that we can get through this. And so you've almost got a bit of a tribe that, you know, of support that you didn't think, you know, some people might not feel like they have the support, even though, you know, family and friends would support them through anything, but they may feel at that time that they feel so isolated that no one can help them get through. But, you know, I think talking to people that have been through the same thing can be so good for someone. And just to even, I don't know, it's something that many people, I think the isolating factor and having a group of people around that has been through the same thing can make a huge difference.
Well, I think it takes the shame away, or certainly lessens the shame to a large degree. And that probably impacts the dialogue in our own head, where we're not being so harsh to ourselves or saying that we're a freak or we're a loser or we're the one who's got this problem and only we have it. Because if you hear other people's stories and you're relating to other people, even better if you can do it in person, then it just takes that away, and it makes you just feel more human and more able to accept yourself. And I think we know the first step is acceptance, and then you can work on it from there. So yeah, I think it's always going to be fundamental in helping people along their mental health journey, just being able to surround yourself with others who've been down a similar path. Tell us about your challenge that you've got coming up, the Double Everest.
Yeah, so this will be our fourth running challenge now over the years, and I The next challenge will basically be I'll be running twice the height of Mount Everest.
As you do.
As you do.
Bit of a stroll.
At our local mountain, Kanyani. And I'm going to be doing it over 7 days. So basically what will entail is I'll get up and start at 7 a.m. in the morning, which will be around sort of first light. And I'll run to the top and run back down and do that over 3 times a day. Probably finish as it gets dark around 6 p.m. and then go home and try and recover and see my family and then come back and do it all again and do it for 7 days straight. And it could be, you know, the average temperature is about 1 degree. I'll be, you know, it'll be snowing up there. It'll be super windy. I've chosen these dates because it's the 10th anniversary of Speak Up, Stay Chatty. It will be on the last day of the run. So I want to be able to finish and celebrate on the 10th anniversary. So that would be really special for me. But I recognize that it's a difficult undertaking to do. And you know, I'm committed to trying to finish on that day, but we'll see. It's really hard to do a 7 day run and know you're going to finish exactly on a certain time. So yeah.
And why are you climbing the mountain, Ben?
So for me, I've always, you know, in all my messages and talking to people, I've always thought that, you know, I've always sort of spoken to the metaphor that, you know, having poor mental health, it really feels like you have to climb a mountain just to do those everyday sort of tasks, like getting out of bed, you know, getting out the door. And it really felt like me when I was, you know, at my worst, it felt so difficult to get out of bed. And you know, I always say, you know, even climbing that mountain, you get to the top and you think you're done. And no, there's, you know, that could be half the mountain. So you've got more to go. And so it is that, it feels like that constant grind and that constant climbing. But I always say, you know, and I always use it in the context of running where there's, you have a support crew around you, you know, and, you know, so you need, once you get to that top, you need your support crew to keep helping you keep climbing. So that says your family and friends, you know, that don't feel ashamed to, you know, reach out and get people to help you, you know, in those sort of situations. So for us, being able to climb a mountain each time, we're doing it day to day, and I'm doing it 3 times a day. And, you know, to really symbolize that those struggles of people that are having to, you know, navigate their lives under, you know, dealing with a mental illness and you know, challenges. And it's something that people don't see, you know, it's an invisible sort of illness that, you know, if you don't know the signs, people don't recognize what you're going through. So really highlighting that but getting the community involved to climb the mountain together.
I love the symbolism, mate, and I love how ambitious you're being with it as well. I'm very much in awe of the idea of climbing that mountain 3 times a day for 7 days. It's pretty hard for me to wrap my head around, but that means it's the right sort of challenge because it's a sort of thing that seems impossible, but you've faced seemingly impossible feats before and managed to knock them out of the park. So I've got no doubt that you'll do it again. How can we get behind you and support you for this?
Yeah, so obviously I'm raising vital funds for Speak Up, Stay Chatty. So there is a fundraising page there, and we will do most of our, like, if you want to be able to hear about the run and follow it, you know, our social media channels, so Run for Mental Health on Facebook and on Instagram is probably the best way to follow it. And we'll be, you know, doing lots of updates and videos, and I'll also have a tracker on me too, so people can kind of track where I am on the mountain. And if you are following along and it doesn't, if the dot is in a different spot, don't freak out. It's probably running out of battery. But, you know, just so people, if people want to come and support locally as well, they know where I'm going to be. So they're not kind of waiting. Yeah, we want to be able to, I think the main thing is I like to have people, you know, they've gone and talked, you know, they've gone and saw the run or saw it on Facebook. I want you to be able to go back home, and when you're having dinner with your family, go, you know, that's the discussion point. You know, I saw this guy doing this thing, and maybe that's a chance to just just normalize talking about some of these conversations. So that's like for that whole week, there'll be all those types of conversations happening.
Love your work, mate. And it will spark heaps of conversations, which is what it's all about. So fantastic stuff. I will have a link in the description for this podcast for people to go and donate if they can. Wicked, man. And it's July 12th that we're starting, right?
That's right. Yeah, Wednesday, July 12th.
Beautiful. All right. Well, look forward to following that on Instagram and keeping you accountable on the tracker. And just, yeah, wishing you all the best with that, man. And Godspeed up on that mountain 3 times a day, every day for a week. It's not for the faint-hearted, but, yeah, amazing stuff, mate. So good on you.
Thanks so much, mate. And thanks so much for having me on. It's always amazing to talk to, you know, inspiring people like you and really, really, like, you don't get it, always get the chance to talk about this sort of stuff, and it's so, because it's so valuable. So thank you.
Thanks, man. It's an important story to hear.
That's it for this episode. If you like what we're all about, support us by following Youngblood Men's Mental Health on Instagram and Youngblood Mental Health on TikTok. Every podcast episode is recorded in professional quality video, and they're all up on our Youngblood Men's Mental Health YouTube channel. So please show some love and subscribe. Thanks to our local business supporters, Herd Financial. You can find everything there is to know about the podcast at youngbloodmensmentalhealth.com. And most importantly, please share these stories with anyone in your life who needs to know they're not alone. We're all in this together. Catch you next time.